Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shops. By Polar, winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, last year we sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. To help out, go to challengedathletes.org. And you can check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here. One of our favorite guests of all time, motocross champion, supercross champion, Ironman world champion, Mr. David Bailey joins us. David, how you doing?
Doing great, Bob. Good morning.
Hey, always a pleasure, bud. Hey, so what I want to do is go back to the beginning. What got you into motocross to begin with?
It was my real dad, Terry Martin, who was shaping surfboards for Hobie up in Dana Point. The famous On Any Sunday, Malcolm Smith.
Oh, yeah.
He had gotten the Hobie guys all into riding, and so invited us up to Ascot Park to watch some flat track. And not long after that, got out to some motocross races. And then just, you know, I was young, and my parents separated at that point, and my mom remarried to Gary Bailey. And Gary, who I didn't even know, when I went and watched the first motocross out at Saddleback Park, I saw Roger DeCosta and Joel Robert and Torsten Holm and all the great Europeans. He was like, let's go see the Europeans, you know? And I didn't know what he was talking about. But I got out there, and it had a huge impact on me. I came home and rode my bicycle around, my Schlin Stingray, and crushed up dirt clods on the sidewalk and get sideways and making jumps. And on summers, I'd spend a week or two with my mom, and she was with Gary, and I rode a mini bike. And we were back east. And I was traveling and somewhere completely different and from what I'd been used to growing up in Southern California, and riding this mini bike. And then one summer it was time to come home, and it's pretty heavy, really, to think about. But I ended up staying and grew up basically in the Winnebago riding a mini bike all the time. And Gary, being sort of the pioneer of motocross, he in America, he kind of just guided me along. And I grew up like that in the Winnebago, going from place to place. Well, he taught a big class, 40 or 50 riders, how to ride safely and more efficient. And I just observed all that as I was like 10, 11, 12 years old. And eventually I started riding in the school, and then he'd have me demonstrate once in a while because I knew what was going on. And he's like, man, if these students would see me, you know, this young kid
right riding,
demonstrating what he was talking about, then, they would be like, well, okay, I guess we've got no excuse. So it was kind of that slow down, think about what you're doing a little bit in order to be able to go faster. And so I learned, you know, the fundamentals right off the bat. And then I had a lot of, you know, the genes, I guess, from my dad, Terry Martin.
Sure.
Creativity and being able to analyze things and have really great balance. You know, I got a lot of that from my mom as well. And so it's pretty wild and sort of a fractured upbringing, but it sort of, you know, just poured
me through
this funnel. And what came out was just this person ready to do well in motocross.
And when did you have when did you start racing at that level where, okay, I think I could be one of the best here?
I was about 15.
Yeah.
16 years old, and I was riding for a Spanish company called Bull Taco.
Oh, yeah.
Their American base was in New York, so we spent some time up there. And eventually, you know, just driving around in Winnebago, that was my bedroom, and, you know, up over the driver's seats. pulled that up once a day, and then the garage basically was the trailer we pulled around. But we went to a place in Virginia, right by Martinsville, and he was just there to do a school and the usual. And as we pulled in, it was the most impressive facility that I'd seen and that he had seen. And we'd been around to a lot of famous places, and this one was all new. And the guy that owned it just really loved it and wanted it to have a great facility. And so they had big races there, big nationals. And he said, hey, why don't you have a kind of a home base for this motocross school, and I'll sell you an acre over there on the other side of the hill. And so we settled down there, and that's when I first started going back to school. He went to a private school there, and I was in like 7th, 8th, and 9th grade at the same time. I was all messed up in school. And the principal of the school, actually, he'd come and see me race one time. And he said, you know, I don't often, actually have never suggested this, but since you're so, you know, kind of mixed up in school and spent some time away, consider pursuing this motocross and traveling the world. And it looks like you're really good at it. And if you're trying to go to school, you're going to miss so many days. I'm not sure how effective that's going to be, and it might mess up your opportunity to do what you're clearly really good at. So travel the world and get an education and see how that works out. And so, yeah, that was another sort of a heavy decision. And so I just went all in, and I spent every bit of time I had to train, work on bikes, understand bikes. And because we had traveled all these different places from, you know, Florida and New York and, you know, down in the South and Alabama and Mississippi and Tennessee, Michigan, I had raced against different people on different types of soil and tracks, that I had a really good ability to adapt. And so once I started doing well, I got things figured out real quick. And then at that point, Gary, he kind of didn't know what to tell me anymore. He would just get the camera and film it.
Right. You probably passed the level where he could do much to help.
Yeah, I mean, he was always there to kind of just make a suggestion once in a while. But, you know, the filming was pretty new.
Right.
And for me to be able to see what I looked like was completely different than what I thought I was doing. And so that became, you know, the next kind of tool to help me to really get better. And so I sort of cleaned up all the things I didn't like the way I looked. And, you know, once that was sort of polished off, then it just sort of created my style, I guess, of my technique, which a lot of people, you know, they sort of feel like I was the more technical and
right,
smooth-looking rider. And a lot of that was just lazy. Kind of. I didn't want to go. I wanted to ride all the time, but I didn't want to be thrashed, and I didn't want it to be scary. I wanted to know what I was doing and not be able to, not have to cross my fingers. You know, when I went through a section, I wanted to know that I could, exactly how I could do it, and I could do it that way every single time. So once I mastered that, man, I was just set for being able to race at the top level. And eventually that guy, Roger DeCoster, the Europeans we went to see in 1968 at Saddleback, he was my team manager, called me and said, I'd like to ride for Honda. So it was a dream.
Wow. And at that point, how big was motocross/supercross in the U.S.? Or were you guys sort of part of that growing phase?
Yeah, that was I was really super fortunate in the timing of it all, because it was really big in the 60s in Europe. But in motocross, I just this Sunday, I went to Isimi Valley to the Hopetown Grand Prix reunion. It was a track out there, Corganville, I think, and then Bob Hope bought it, and then it became Hopetown. And some of the Europeans came over, and they did this big race there. And Bruce Brown did on any Sunday.
Yep.
Film. It was on Wide World of Sports. And that was the late 60s, early 70s. And I missed all that because at that point I had already been with my mom and Gary, and I was on the East Coast. So to see that Sunday was pretty neat. And it was really the reminder of the birth of motocross here in the States, which was right around 69, 70, right around in there. Supercross wasn't even a thing yet.
Right.
And then in 72, kind of simultaneous with motocross becoming an event at the LA Coliseum, and it was a sellout, huge. A lot of Europeans came over and raced in that, and they had like a mud hole, and they went up through the stands up into the peristyle and jumped back down.
Oh my God.
That was considered the Super Bowl of motocross, and it was huge. At the same time, because we were sort of stationed down there at Daytona, they had a big Florida Winter Amps thing, and the promoter there told Bill France, who had a bike week, they had every other kind of bike racing and road racing and flat track and enduro, and they're like, why don't we have a motocross as well? And so they figured, well, let's get Gary Bailey and see if he would help us make a track or something here in the stadium at the Speedway. And so they had a motocross there, and that was also in 72.
Wow. I just came back from Daytona, and it's so funny because when I was at the Speedway, I'm thinking, I thought of David Bailey, and you're in their hall of the Goodyear Hall of Fame down there.
Yeah, it's pretty neat because I had a key to gate 7. I could just go in and out, and I'd ride my bicycle around the track, and we'd be down there in January, early February, before they we had other places to go. But they just let us stay in the Speedway, and he would build the track right there in the triangle between the front straightaway of the big Speedway and then pit road, all that grass strip.
Yep.
So he'd go out there and dig ditches and build jumps, and they had a huge Supercross there. It was called Motocross, and then eventually it became Supercross. And so that sort of connected up to having one race there, one race at the Houston Astrodome, and one at Texas Stadium where the Dallas Cowboys play at the old stadium. And it became the Super Series and then eventually Supercross. And I was a kid riding pretty well local and winning a lot of amateur stuff and watching everybody that was the best and having that kind of access. You know, I could go out there and putt around on the track a little bit and had access to the pits, and I got to know all the riders, and I got comfortable around that environment. And so it was probably, several years after all that stuff, when Supercross got to become a big deal, that I turned pro in 1979. When I was 16, I turned pro.
Wow.
And I got smoked right off the bat. The good guys, Hannah, they lapped me. And I remember thinking, I was in Atlanta at a national, about behind like turn 3 of the Atlanta International Speedway, the motocross track out there. And Hannah had a broken left hand, so it was casted, but he had it casted in sort of a, you know, a bent fashion so he could use the clutch and hold on to the grip. And he lapped me. And on the drive home, I thought, I'm never going to be that good.
Wow.
And so I had big doubts. And Gary said, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Keep improving. And a lot of these guys they're older. They've been around doing this a long time. They've got so much experience. And, you know, they're in their late 20s and kind of their career is going to be kind of getting towards the end. Right about the time you're going to be really starting to get things wired. So just don't give up. Keep improving. And you're going to float right up there. And pretty soon you're going to be battling with the top 10 guys. And who knows from there. So I kind of hung in there.
Yeah.
And got a couple little breakthroughs. And then Kawasaki started this program called Team Green. And I was based out of Atlanta. And that's when Bultaco kind of just went out of business. And I got off the Bultaco onto the Kawasaki. And I won a championship the very next year in 1980. And then I got that call from DeCoster in 1982. So I really got going in 1981, 82 area, and in the time frame. And at the same time, Supercross became big, and it was all over the country, and the Nationals were big. And then in 82, the end of that year, as an alternate, I got invited over to Germany and then Switzerland for two world championship team races, the Motocross of Nations, they call it. And we won again. I was like 6th, 4th, 2nd, you know, kind of up in there, just getting the points for the team. But we won it. And when I came home from that trip, I had really grown up, really matured, really seen what motocross was like on the world stage. And the guy who got hurt there, Donnie Hansen, I filled those shoes. I was nervous, you know, like, man, those are big shoes to fill because he won everything in 82. And when 83 started, DeCoster and the guys at Honda had signed Bob Hanna, who was a hero of mine growing up. And now I'm on the team with them. And we went out to the desert and rode together and tested a lot. And when Anaheim 1 came around, first Supercross of the year, I won it. And, man, that was just like, I couldn't believe what was happening. But I realized that I was one of the guys.
Right.
And once you taste that first win in front of the big crowd, that was like the biggest race of the year. And so I finally understood, like, okay, this is actually happening. I didn't get lucky. I'm one of the guys. And it was a little bit of a tricky, you know, to learn how to, I mean, I just felt like a kid. I kind of still wanted to get some autographs. So,
when you still were a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know how to behave, you know. I'm not better than these guys, am I? And I almost felt bad. And but I started getting used to it, and I had a lot of good people around me at Honda going, you know, don't put the Sharpie away.
Put the Sharpie away.
Yeah, just get out there and do your job, you know. And so the next year in 84, I won Daytona, which
wow.
was a really neat one that sticks out because that I grew up there and I watched all those Supercrosses from the very beginning. I remember being in Jim Prance's office when they were talking over plans for the track, and we're going to go across pit road out into there and make the lap times longer, and watching the, you know, Buddy Baker, Richie Petty, and those guys come down there in the early part of the year testing for the Daytona 500. So I knew all the flaggers and the people that worked there. I knew everybody's name. And for them to see me win was probably kind of cool, too. Last couple laps, they'd come out on the track and be waving like, man, I remember you when you were just a kid. So, it was pretty neat. I was so lucky when I think back and look at how everything sort of panned out.
That was a pretty cool era of you know, motocross, when you have yourself and Ricky Johnson and Johnny O'Mara and Hanna still around. Could you, even though you're on the same team with those guys, could you be friends with them? Because you got to beat them on race day.
Yeah, I was friends, you know, I mean, once, it was a bummer. Donnie Hansen, he was just before me. He and O'Mara were really good friends.
Yep.
Both up from, you know, like, Donnie was in Saugus and Johnny was in Simi Valley, so not too far. And they would ride at the same places, and they both trained a lot. They're good friends. And when Donnie got hurt, it was a head injury, and that just cleared the path for me. So he won everything in 82, and then in 83, he couldn't quite make a comeback yet. And he never actually did, but he was trying.
Right.
And in 83, I just filled his shoes, and then I won everything.
Yeah.
And at the same time, Johnny and I became really good friends, and so we started the training thing, and we were actually more into running and doing 10Ks the day after Nationals and Supercrosses. And you know, the Molina and Dave Scott and Mark and all of, we thought triathlon was, to us, motocross was easy. That was what came natural to us, what
yeah.
we were good at. But we really thought it was, we wanted to have that really, I don't know what to call it, but it was very intriguing to us to see somebody be able to do an Ironman or to go in a USTS and swim and bike and run that fast. We were just mesmerized by it and wanted to be that good at that and motocross, and you can't do both. So we overtrained, I think, for a while. And when Rick Johnson came to the team in 1986, that was the first time I ever remember having any sort of of because Rick was a year or two younger than me.
Yeah.
And we came up about the same time. And so I was actually sort of Rick bothered me a little bit. I should be able to beat him.
Right.
You know? And he was intimidating, and he was the guy on the team that I was like, I don't want to let him beat me.
Right.
But yet if he did, that's okay, but not as okay as it was if Johnny did or Bob Hanna did. If they did, I'm like, well, they should. Those guys are good. They were ahead of me. But when Rick came up, that was the first time I was ever really bothered. And we're good friends. I was been back and forth with him yesterday. And we had a lot of respect for each other. But that was the one time on a team where I was sort of intimidated and kind of bugged and not able to be as friendly at the races. You know, we'd go to a movie or you know, some popular movie would come out, like Top Gun 2 or something back in the days. We'd all go or go drive go-karts and things like that. But at the races, man, I wanted to beat Rick pretty bad, and I think it was the same for him. And we made each other a lot better. And then that just, I think that elevated pretty much the whole sport at, you know, around 85, 86. Rick and I were pushing the pace pretty quick.
Well, I remember talking to Johnny, and he was saying that riding with you and training had changed, and it got to the point where that ragged edge just kept getting further and further out, and he was getting a little scared of doing some of the stuff you guys were doing.
Yeah, that was in 86 when Rick came to the team. I had already been at Honda since 82.
Yeah.
And even though Johnny had been there 1 year longer, he hurt his knee in the early part of the season prior to the 86 big, you know, Anaheim opener.
Yeah.
So it was, I won that race, and I thought, okay, I'm where I think I should be. But Rick went back to the drawing board and decided, okay, well, I got to do more. And that's what was really good about, impressive about Rick Johnson, and still is that he's got the ability to continue to up the ante. Even though that you think that you're pretty much at your max, he can somehow manufacture a little bit more. And that's what usually was intimidating to me and kind of bothered me a bit, was I didn't have the ability to do that. And I really wished I had it. And I think that's why I was drawn to Ironman and things like that, was because you got to reach down deep inside and figure out how to get some more. And Rick had the ability to do that. And after I won that race at Anaheim, he got some more. And he beat me in the championship, and then he beat me in the outdoor championship. It wasn't until the very end of the year that I was able to win the 500 championship from him just by a few points. And so going into 87, Johnny had left Honda and went to Suzuki, so we weren't riding as much together. But when we did, he was telling me, he was warning me, like, David, you can't go that fast all the time. You know, we've got limits. Come on, man, you know better. And I just was like, it wasn't completely Rick. It was me just wanting to be able to go faster and dominate.
You wanted to be the best. And
I just was reaching a little bit too much. And especially like when I got hurt, I was reaching for something that was completely not necessary at a race that didn't mean anything, which was just a warm-up race prior to the opening race of the year in 1987 in Anaheim, and fell off, got hurt. Right after that, Rick went to Anaheim, and he was leading the race, battling, and it didn't look like a big crash, but he fell off and knocked himself out. So it was scary, a scary time for motocross and also for Honda, because I got hurt on January 11th, 1987, right before the first race. And then Rick knocked himself out and spent the night going, you know, was I finished in 1987? So that ended my career. And I think a lot of guys, like Johnny, for example, was close to me. It sort of put a dent in their ambition and stuff for a while. And it changed things a bit to where riders thought, gosh, you know, you can get hurt doing this. And it's, I hate that, you know, I've lived with it. And I think Johnny has as well. I wanted to go out on top. And, you know, I accomplished a lot. I won a lot of races. And I did go out on top. But, dang, you know, I didn't know that it was going to end quite like that. And it's pretty hard. It was hard for a little while to go back around to the races and sort of be that sitting example.
Right.
I was like, you know, this could go wrong. You know, I didn't like being around everybody. And, hey, how's it going? Okay, good luck out there.
You know, yeah, did you feel that in terms of the people at, you know, at the events, it's like, well, David Bailey's one of the best ever. But when he comes to the events, he's sort of an example of what can happen. Did you feel that maybe they didn't want you around after you were injured?
Yeah, I felt like that. And I didn't feel that from anybody.
No,
I
just, yeah.
That myself. I was really sensitive. You know, to their, how they might take it and how they would feel. And
sure.
People like, oh, no, we like seeing you, you know, but they're not going to be necessarily always honest.
Right.
You know, completely. And so it wasn't until I got a call from a friend who was producing some television shows and called Moto World.
Yep.
And it was just sort of like a weekly show that just talked about motorcycle racing. And then ESPN called them and said, hey, we'd like to cover the Outdoor Nationals motocross, not supercross. And they called me and said, I'd like to do the color commentating for that. I didn't even fully understand what color commentating, you know, you're just going to be like the analyzing guy.
Right.
Talk about what's going on. Oh, okay, sure. Yeah, I'll do that. So I did that for about 10 years. And the reason that was so natural and all that was because of my upbringing.
Oh, you know, exactly.
I grew up with the whole motocross school thing and really breaking stuff down and being able to explain and teach. And then once I was able to do that from, you know, having been injured and career ending kind of in a bummer way, I wasn't around the pits and around the riders so much. I was up in the TV booth and able to just talk about it. And so it felt, well, it was way more comfortable. And, It came pretty natural, and it was a really fun gig. It kept me involved with the sport for a while, and I think people liked it because they could relate to me. The riders could, and fans were perhaps, you know, a tad more intrigued because of the way that I could explain it compared to what had been done, you know, up until then, which were the people that didn't really race. You know, it was guys that could talk on TV, but they'd never done it. So, yeah, it was a good fit. And then, but the whole time that was happening, I was keeping my eye on this hand cycle stuff that was coming along, and some guy was trying to do the Hawaii Ironman in a chair. And it wasn't long before I just peeled out of the whole TV and all that stuff and wanted to do an Ironman, because I went over there in 1986 with my wife Gina for our honeymoon. We stayed, you know, after that as well. But,
So you came for your, you knew Iron Man was going on at the time.
Yeah.
You came out to watch it.
Yeah, so we got married at right at the pinnacle of my career. We won the USA World Championship, you know, the world against everybody in Italy. No one's ever won with a perfect score like that, you know, up to that point. And I flew to Vermont. We got married, and then we went to the Iron Man. Saw Dave Scott win it again for like the fifth time. And I said, I'm gonna come back and do this someday. And she's like, well, okay, good. I get a vacation.
Yeah, right. So that's October of 86, and then January of 87, you're injured.
Yeah, I got hurt right after that. So I figured, well, that's that. Dave Scott actually came to visit when I was in the hospital. So nice of him. And, you know, at that point, I thought, well, I'm going to get better.
Right.
I've healed from everything else. You know, this is just a bigger injury. It'll take longer, but I'll get better. So I spent a couple of years trying to get better, and then I realized, well, I'm probably not going to get better. And it wasn't until I met this guy, Jim Knopf from Long Beach.
Yeah.
Former pole vaulter, just made a quick transition right to wheelchair racing. And, you know, it was pretty, well, it's pretty primitive, you know. I've looked at some videos on YouTube here recently about Jim in the early days, and, man, there's the guy, like, on a prone gurney with some crutches just jamming along.
That was Bud. Yeah, yeah. And then Jimmy was in, those things were like, they were like shopping carts, right? They were like something you get at the, go over at the Albertsons and let me shove your body in there and go 60 miles an hour down the first 6 miles of Boston.
Yeah, and so picture this. I'm in a hospital bed, and I don't know, sometime 87, and I'm pretty sure that was the year that Jim crashed.
Yes.
At the start of Boston. And so that was a highlight on TV.
Oh, yeah.
And so some people had come by thinking, hey, you should get into wheelchair basketball or maybe wheelchair racing. And somebody had come to the hospital, a guy named Marty Vogel, and he brought his race chair, and it was interesting, but I had no interest in that, you know. I'm like, I just got off of like a custom made, you know, two wheel F1 bike. I'm not going to get in one of those things with no brakes and some gloves with some tape on the finger. I mean, that, no.
Well, and you're going to walk again. At that point, you're like, this is an injury, and I'll get past this, and I'll be back riding my motorcycle.
Yeah. So once I saw that highlight on the news of that big crash at the Boston Marathon, you know, at first I saw it, I'm like, wow, that looks pretty cool. I started for a moment to think, hey, maybe I will do that. And then I saw that crash, I'm like, oh, heck no, forget it. So then, funny that I ended up meeting him in around 1990, I think. And immediately, I was not thinking about, it was a bummer to be in a chair. Like, I'm this disabled guy that needs a push everywhere and help to do everything. Knob was a pretty handsome dude.
Yep.
Real strong.
Willful.
Very sharp. You know, he's talking business. And he had a convertible with a couple of race chairs hanging out the back of it. When I pulled in, I saw that. And they were different than the ones I'd seen before. This was the new chair that Jim had helped make. And it was three wheels, and it had a brake and this big aluminum, you know, good-looking main strut tube that formed the chair. And I thought, man, that's a neat design. I want one of those.
There you go.
And so I went in and met him and went to lunch, and it was actually Eric Neitzel. His was the other chair in there. And I've been training with him lately, which is kind of a full circle deal. But once I met Jim and started, I got in a race chair, and I raced with Eric in Mission Bay, I did a 10K, and then I did Long Beach, and then LA, and then Jim said, hey, why don't we go to Boston?
Yep.
I was hooked, but there was no hand cycle yet. When I did see finally a hand cycle, I was kind of irritated with it. Like, get that thing out of here, man. No fairs, shifting and stuff.
Right.
And then I didn't really like them, and then I got one of those, and the whole freedom aspect, you know, getting on the race chair was a form of freedom, like it's a bicycle when I was a kid. But getting on a hand cycle was another whole level of more freedom. And then Ironman creeped back up, you know, and I was there in 86 thinking I wanted to do it and got hurt. It was that ended.
Right.
But when I saw a hand cycle and got on that, then I started thinking about doing that again. At the time, I was working at No Fear. I don't know what the heck I was doing. They just gave me a desk. We're doing some cycling gear. And I met Todd at a Supercross through a friend, Todd Jacobs, who had done Ironman. I knew who he was. I had pictures of him and stuff. I think he was 8 the year I was there.
Yeah, he was.
So I said, hey, come by and, you know, if you got any ideas or want to test any of the stuff we've got, let me know. And he just said, well, what I'd do is just make some jerseys out of that flannel fabric that, you know, that was real popular then. Make it out of that stuff. You know, do something different. And so I made it, and that just kind of changed everything, mountain bike. And so they hired him as well. And so we're sitting there together, and I didn't realize that I was bothering the hell out of Todd. He did not want to talk about triathlon.
He was tired of it.
Yeah, he had had his injury.
That
his ankle.
Ankle, yeah.
You know, he had a bad taste in his mouth about things and his relationship and Lisa and stuff. So I did not know any of that. I wasn't sensitive at all to what his thoughts were about it. I just was thinking, man, I'm sitting next to a guy that's, you know, rubbed shoulders with Dave Scott and and Armstrong and LeMond and all those guys, and they come to town in the winter to ride bikes. And I was just so happy. And he finally, just to get me to kind of shut up, he was like, why don't you just do a triathlon and then we can get back to work.
Yeah.
So he carried me into the swim in Carlsbad for that little triathlon there, called Jill Pritchard and said, hey, could you, I can put him in a wave you can just get swam over the top of. And so I had a little buffer behind me, you know, till the next wave. And
you had to get in the surf.
Yeah.
It's not like that's not a lake, a bay swim. That's that you get some big surf there.
I was stressed out about that. You know, and then also there's fish out there.
Yeah, there are fish, big fish, yeah.
And so I was always a little bit nervous about that, and Todd doesn't worry about that stuff.
Nah.
He's like looking at me like, look, man, you know the odds of that. So I'm like, well, if people have seen big sharks out there, you know, 10, 12 foot. He's like, you know how they exaggerate, Dave, it's probably only 9 feet.
Yeah, so, like it's a difference.
So he swam with me and rode the bike with me in the back of the pack, and that was his first experience, really, of seeing what it was like back there, because he's off the front. Usually.
Right.
And he just started to, I think, in from his perspective, he's going, you know, no wonder they have, like, triathlon camps and things. And people got their helmet on backwards, they got their swim cap on still, one guy had jeans, another guy... Yeah, TT bike, but he was walking it in his cycling shoes. Something had happened, and he's like, "Man, this is hilarious. You know, I've never seen all this stuff." And he started to enjoy, I think, a little bit how good he had it and how good he was,
right.
And smelling the roses just a little bit and enjoying watching me have that same passion he had in the beginning. So as soon as I crossed the finish line, the opposite thing happened. You know, he thought I would be like, okay, that's hard, forget it, let's get back to work. Instead, I was like, okay, now I want to train for Kano.
Exactly. And at the same time, you had, you know, John Franks in 94 trying to make the, when we first got wheelchairs into Kona, he missed the bike cutoff time, and then John McClain from Australia missed it in 95, 96, but then he made all the cutoff times in 97. And then it looked, is that the point you're thinking, okay, now let's go do it?
Yeah, I went and watched it in 97.
Yeah.
Had all these miles added up, and Gina was at home with the kids. And well, why don't you and Todd just go?
Oh, so you came over in 97 to watch.
Yeah, so I went over there, and I met John Franks and another guy, Scott McNeese, who was pretty good.
Yep.
He had won the Lubbock qualifier and beat John. And so you know, I'm watching the bike check in and looking at their stuff. Man, I want one of those. And when John, he was a good swimmer. He swam like 103 or
yep.
something. He came out of the swim, and we were at the top of the fan save, Bonnie. And when he came up the hill, you know, I'm in my chair, easy to spot. And I rolled out just a bit to kind of like, you know, check him out, maybe take a picture. And he rode over towards me and kind of like high-fived me. And pointed, sort of, like it was a gesture, like, I'm doing this, like, today, but next year, you're doing it. It was kind of a
wow.
pass the baton.
Love
and
that.
So, on the flight from Kona back to Honolulu, when everyone was leaving on Monday, I ended up in the seat right next to John McClain.
What are the odds on that?
He goes, hey, you want to see something cool? I'm like, yeah. And he takes out this little green box, and he takes the lid off, and there's the Iron Man medal. And, man, I was just like, I want one of those. I don't care what it takes. And so I came home and quit my job at No Fear and just started training full time. And
wow.
Todd was like, are you sure about that? Like, I don't want Gina thinking that I'm over here trying to, you know, talk you into quitting jobs and stuff. I mean, you know, this is a hobby, Dave. The same motocross. You're not getting paid a bunch of money to do this stuff. I mean, you got a family.
Yeah.
But I was just, I wanted to do what made me happy, and I wanted to do what I had wanted to do since 1986. And, you know, I felt like I had sort of done all I could do at No Fear. And then at that point, I was still doing a little bit of TV. And it just worked out. Went to Lubbock. I won that. And there was some guy there named Carlos Molina who I'd heard of. I'd raced him in wheelchair racing, but I usually was ahead. And so I wasn't intimidated by him at all.
Navy SEAL.
Dick Johnson.
Yeah.
You know, same thing. When I won that big race at Anaheim and Rick was second, I thought, well, I got him covered. But he went home and
went to work.
manufactured some more speed and some more desire and some more motivation, and he beat me. And the same thing did happen with Carlos. He realized, okay, well, I need to be a little bit quicker. So when I saw him in Kona, he had the exact same bike I did, except it was black. It was like the Intimidator. And he just smoked me. I was sick and had some stuff, but still, I would have probably won anyway. Carlos was just, he's just a badass.
He is a badass.
The thing about it was that, you know, and Todd put it this way to me. He goes, you know, Dave, here's what you got basically on your plate. You got this Ironman, and it's great and all to go over there and finish it and get a T-shirt and one of the medals, but there's one other guy on this planet that wants the same thing, and he wants it more. And you got to deal with that. And if it's okay with you to just go over there and get a T-shirt and a medal, well, cool, you know, good job. But from what I'm sensing, it seems like you want to beat this guy, and you probably ought to, so it's time to go to work. And I've never trained so hard in my life. I mean, for motocross, it's a lot of skill and technique more than just the training, which, again, was part of why I was so attracted to triathlons and stuff. And so I had to dig and go out and bonk on purpose and do big 100 milers and come back, get in the race chair when it didn't feel like it, you know, 3:30 in the afternoon, and go out and do another 10 or 15 miles hard. And just one time I fell asleep on the floor in the bathroom of my house and I still had my helmet on. And Gina came home and turned on the light. Like, oh my God, what are you doing? And it's funny now, but at the time, man, it was a war.
Right.
And I didn't have the kind of background that Carlos did. I mean, he was a
Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
I
didn't have to swim across a pool with my arms and hands tied behind my back and, you know, damn near drown. I didn't have that kind of training. But he did. And he's a little bit more able than I am. I'm injured up by the chest, and he's injured down low in the waist. So he's got abs and a little bit lighter.
Right.
So he can climb good. And on paper, he's the better man. But Todd said, Dave, he's just a man.
Yep.
And you just have to be tougher. And you got to stick with this guy. You're not just going to run away from him. He's going to go hard. He's not going to show you a weakness. I don't know that he's even got one. So this is important. You've got to beat this guy, and you've got to at least give it your best. And if he beats you, go shake his hand. But if you can beat him, then do it. You know, he was getting fired up. I thought about it a lot when I was out there going, you know, this rising to the occasion or kind of just shrinking from it, I can't live with that. And so the third year that we battled each other, I was prepared to end up on a cot with an IV or in the hospital. I mean, I was ready to go that deep.
Yeah.
And that's what it actually took to finally pass Carlos. And as soon as I did, I got a flat. I'm like, no!
Oh, yeah, you caught him on the bike, and then you made up a gap and caught him on the bike, and then you flatted right in town.
Yeah, I had I went around the hot corner, and there was some people crossing the street, and I got sort of my wires crossed, and I went out in the dirt a little bit. And a little while later, my right rear flat went flat.
Yeah.
And Carlos was right behind me, and I kind of looked back at him a little bit, like, you see that? And he just shook his head like, that sucks. That's a mess, you know. So he didn't, bolt and take off. It wasn't like he had the energy to get anyway. But he rode with me until that last.
That climb by the racket,
yeah.
The racket club.
And it wasn't like we were going slow. We were going probably 17-ish, you know, or something like that with the flat. Because on a hand cycle with three wheels, you can get away with that.
Yeah.
And, but we got to the hill. He hammered. When we got onto the chair, I didn't have any energy. I used it all on the bike and thinking, you know, this is the finish line. I just wanted to be ahead of him for once, just for once.
Yeah.
And then that happened, and I was spent. And I got about, I don't know, through town, everyone's giving me the, oh, good job anyway.
The golf clap. The golf clap. I love it. Mom's birthday, you're getting the golf clap. That's great.
And I was just inside. I was just so kicked off and getting different splits and things. You know, oh, it's, you got it. He's right there. And, oh, he's 6 minutes. Like, make up his damn mind. So I got so irritated. It's just, you know, I don't want to say it, but I'd had it.
Right.
You know? And so I just started hammering. And right at the top of Kalani, I think we had to go right that year just a bit and make a hard left.
Yep. There was a little loop, yeah.
So I went down that hill coasting, and we're fast on the race chair going down that hill where Dave and Mark, you know, passed each other coming up it. We're going down that, you know, heading out to Energy Lab, and when I finally started, you know, getting to the point where I could start pushing again off that downhill, I just started hammering like a sprint. I don't know where I got the energy. I was just so mad. And I just kept going and going and going. And right before we went into Energy Lab, I saw this little speck up there that didn't look like a runner. And I just thought, that's him. I think that's him. And as we went down into the Energy Lab and to the turnaround down there, I realized, man, I'm reeling this guy in. Maybe, just maybe, he's kind of on a bunk because – he really tried hard to get away from me early in the marathon, and what I did was my neck hurt real bad. It's hard to look up. I don't know what I did, but it was hard to look up. And so I decided to get a lot of food through town where there's just so much traffic and congestion and aid stations and stuff. I just got a lot of food so that when I got up to the Green K, I wouldn't have to stop again. I could just hammer. And I think Carlos did the opposite, and he started running out of energy when I started feeling, you know, like, okay, now I started to feel good. And when I caught him, it was just everything that it had taken from, you know, motocross and visiting there in 1986 and those losses to him and in 98 and 99, all of that, it took every bit of it. And every bit of Todd going, Dave, it's not enough. You got to do more. This is everything. It's your life. You can't go over here and come up short, not three times. You're going to not ever sleep good again. You understand? It really was. We made it important. It was a war, and I really wanted to beat him. And so, thankfully, I'm grateful that he was in the way, because if he hadn't have been, I don't know what it would have meant. I don't know if we'd be on the phone right now, as a matter of fact. So, hats off to Carlos for being such a great competitor and somebody that pushed me to those limits.
That was one of my favorite things, was you caught him basically just coming out of the Energy Lab. And that photo of you that we have on the wall at CAF is right from that moment, the moment you had just passed him, your full on, and then when you headed to town, I remember grabbing Gina to get her into the finish area, and you're like, Dave, do you want to go get a massage? And no, I need to wait for Carlos. And the other part of that whole buildup was you guys had become Dave Scott and Mark Allen. I mean, everybody knew this 3-year battle, and the chair sort of disappeared, the disability sort of disappeared. It was two great athletes who wanted to kick the other guy's ass, which really helped, to me, solidify why we have the chairs and hand cycles in the race, right? So when Carlos came across the line, you guys touched gloves, and what'd you say to him?
Something along the lines of, thanks for pushing me to a level that I wouldn't have reached by myself.
Yeah,
you know?
Which is the essence of sport, right? You needed Ricky Johnson. Ricky Johnson needed you. You guys, Johnny O'Meara, all those guys helped make you better at what you did. And you needed Carlos to have that ultimate race, or else if you had won it in 98, I bet you probably might not even come back.
Yeah, maybe not. I would have been like, okay, well, I did that. And what's next?
Exactly.
You know, there was, I did enjoy the Ironman. And if I could stuff myself into a race chair still, I had knee issues and stuff. And then I'd be tempted. Because I love that event. I love the swim, you know, even though I still get nervous out there with the fish. I did such a gorgeous swim that the comfort of the temperature of that water, the way everything looks, that Kona Coast Highway, the Queen K, and all the history there, all the athletes that have been up and down there. It's just something about that place where some people think, oh, it just looks desolate and it's lava. And I'm like, I like it. It's a wonderful place to train. I got to go over there in 2001 and do some of that. And I rode every day from out there by the Hilton in the town back. And I loved it. And it was really windy and awful, but I've always enjoyed that place. And to be able to go out there and compete like we did, and to even have that division, I mean, thank you, Bob. I met you over there in 88 when Franks was trying to make a run at it. And then to be able to have that kind of an event that did sort of solidify that division was just an honor, you know, really. And kind of, I remember watching Mark. I was there in 89 and watched that battle when Mark and Dave were battling all day. And I was on a lead just listening, you know, to Riley talk about their side by side. It's mile 23. They still haven't said a word to each other. You know, just waiting with goosebumps, like, who's it going to be, you know?
Right.
And so it felt a little bit like that with Carlos and I, even though we're buried back there in the pack. We were duking it out. And Carlos was the man. He went back over there and won again, I think, once or twice. And so I really didn't, you know, dethrone him or anything. I just got one from him on that day. And what I had to go through to do that was I'm grateful to Carlos for having that experience, for you guys and Ironman and CAF for helping me with all the things that were required to get to that level, and Todd Jacobs for having that experience in hindsight to be able to pour it into my brain and go, look, Dave, you know, here's how to go about it. And so anybody that's been over there can tell you that it's a personal quest. It's kind of selfish and all that, sort of socially irresponsible. But at the same time, there's a lot of other people that do get involved to help you perform at that level. And so thanks to everyone. And,
oh, of course.
And yeah, it was a neat experience to look back on. I'm glad I did it. And every time it's a full moon, man, I look up and think, Kona time.
So one of my favorite stories was when you're riding out in Camp Pendleton. And this is before you rode in Kona, and you're with Todd, and you're asking Todd, because it was pretty windy out there in Vandegrift.
We were going. They used to let you go out that road, and they don't now. But we were going out that way. That was like 30 miles an hour going east. But we flipped it around, and we're heading back. And I was doing like 11, and it was so windy. Some of the strongest wind I've been in, where it's just steady, strong, like it's invisible, but it's amazing how much of a force it is. And you just can't believe it, you know, like, is this going to let up? And I looked at him, and, you know, I have to, like, yell so you can even hear me. And I'm like, is it this windy in Kona? And he's like, what? This windy? Yeah. In the lobby at night. And I thought he was kidding, you know, he joked around. And, in 98, when I got over there and did the race, I got out by that scenic lookout where you drop down into Kohola.
Yep.
And that wind, except more of it, like it must have been at least twice as bad all the way to Javi. And I thought, well, cool, you know, when I flip it around there, I'm behind a bit, but I'm good for the long haul. And, you know, we're only halfway into this thing, so I'll get that tailwind and be all set. And when I turned around, it wasn't a tailwind. It was kind of an annoying cross.
It's cross. Wind. It's always cross. Yeah, it's
and
brutal.
And then I got back onto the Queen K. It was still kind of a crossing headwind. I just broke me. And I remember Mark Allen saying on one of those broadcasts, like, you can do good anywhere else, but Ironman, this island is different. It breaks people. Breaks people like you wouldn't believe. And I was one of those people. And that's why, you know, Carlos was already showered and had dinner by the time I got to the finish line. And, you know, that just motivated me to want to dig deeper and be the best that I could be. And I finally got to reach that point in 2000.
Originally, what did Jim Knob say to you to get you back to wanting to be an athlete again? Because at that point, you know, being in sport was pretty much gone for you.
Yeah, I was whining about everything.
Right.
And everything was a hassle. You know, well, I used to be able to do this. And then he goes, Bailey, why don't you start focusing on what you can do and quit worrying about what you can't do? I remember that was a big thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had another saying that he said, why walk when you can fly? And I didn't quite grasp that early on because I was still bummed out. You know, like, man, it's no fair. You know, why, not just me. Like, why would anybody have to get hurt and have to deal with you too, Jim? Shoot. And he goes, Bailey, it doesn't bother me. I'm not in this chair. It's like I use it to get around, but I'm not in it. It doesn't define me. And I started to kind of get it a little bit more. Like, all right, you know, like whatever comes your way and whatever sort of circumstances that you end up in, whether it was just a poor decision or just life, then you can whine about it or you can do your best and figure out a way to use that in like a gift. And so Jim, I think of his trajectory and go, you know, if he'd have kept going and pole vaulting, then who knows what would have happened. He would have done well and all that. But man, five Boston's,
yep.
You know?
Yep.
Two or three when I knew him. And, you know, then he'd have to leave because we'd room together. And then he'd leave and go, you know, for a run with the president. And he was winning the course record, the American record, and the world record. And I think each of those was like a pretty nice bonus. So it was a big payday. He knew everyone in Boston. And he got to travel around the world and do quite a bit of other stuff. And invited me down to Australia for the Oz Day 10K. And we went to Hamilton Island. Went out and swam with the Great Barrier Reef. And I went skydiving and landed on the beach in front of our bungalow. We're having breakfast with dolphins swimming around next to us. And yeah, I'm like, man, I never thought that a wheelchair, you know, life in a wheelchair or injured and needing one to get around was going to lead to things like this, you know. And as he saw me starting to kind of get pointed in the right direction, then he kind of eased off and we still talk, but not as much. And I think for Jim, he helped so many people.
Yep.
Figure that out. And that's really what his gift was like, I'm going to, you know, whoever's running this ship just basically just said, Jim, I'm going to give you the ability to do well for a while. And then you're going to not only inspire other people, but probably help a lot of Baileys that come along. And so I was just one of the guys that came into his life for a little while. And he didn't give me any sort of what I wanted to hear. He gave me what I needed to hear and the tough love. And plus he could go out and whip my ass. And so I'm very grateful to him for just being honest.
Yeah.
You know, and then later when I met Todd, he was also honest. He yep. still is. You know, he didn't tell me what I want to hear. He tells me what I need to hear. And at times, and as much as I don't really like that in life, you know, people just kind of come at you. If it's what I need to hear, then shoot,
that's
know?
The way it is.
Let me hear it, and then I'll go and make those adjustments and grow some. And so
my favorite Jim Knopf story when you know we're new magazine and just realized how rich the stories were with athletes like Jim Knopf, former pole vaulter. He invites Lois and I over to his house, and you know there's a nickel on the floor. And I'm like, oh, my God, poor guy. You know, he's in a wheelchair. He can't pick it up. And I go to try to pick this nickel up, which is glued to the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. And basically he's sitting there with a beer going, so, Babbitt, you didn't think the poor wheelchair guy could pick up the nickel off the frickin' ground? And I'm like, you got me. Yeah. He basically was telling me, dude, don't underestimate anybody. It just give them the equipment or whatever the hell they need, the support to do what they want to do and get the hell out of the way. And that's, I love about that guy. And I, you know, you're doing that now with Eric Neitzel, you know, and certainly did that with Ricky James. So you're sort of following that tradition.
Yeah. I watched an interview with Jim and I think Willie Firestone, I think. And,
yeah.
On there, Jim said, you know, you don't really fully realize the gift until you're able to pass it along.
Oh, that's such a good line.
So, you know, I didn't, you get involved in what you're doing. It's all kind of selfish and stuff for a while. And then when you're able to give that experience and share that with somebody else and see them, you know, kind of dig out of somewhere or do a little bit better. And then be an inspiration to somebody else, and it just kind of keeps on passing that forward. And, you know, that's really where the I'm as happy to see that, and it's as fulfilling and satisfying to see that as it is to do it yourself.
Love it.
You know, and Todd told me that a long time ago. He goes, you know, seeing you do that, I was as happy as I was when I did it myself. And I thought, well, you know, oh, shoot, that's nice of him to say and all, you know. And I know what you mean, but it can't be that good. But then when I watched Ricky do it,
yep,
man, I was like, I was crying.
It's the best. You know, it's the best.
He moved, and, you know, I mean, I saw his sisters and his mom and dad, and they, you know, that kind of put me over the top. But it means a lot when you see somebody do well. And having been through that myself, you know, it means that much more. So whenever I see somebody at CAF, you know, they – get into it and start doing well, then
it's the best.
I've done that, and so it's really cool to see it being done, and who knows what's next.
Absolutely. Big D, as always, thank you for taking so much time. It's always such a pleasure to chat with you, my man.
Yep, thank you for all you've done for me, and I'll see you out there.
Big David Bailey has been our guest again. We're brought to you by UCAN. Perform, workout, energize. That's GenerationUCAN.com. By VeloFix.com. The world's coolest mobile bike shops. By Polar. Winners are made of blood, sweat, and data. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We sent out 3,260 grants totaling $4.8 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport to help out. Go to ChallengedAthletes.org and check out any of our interviews on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and Babbittville.com. As always, endurance lives here.